The lyrics of Francis Scott Key are ringing out in Hong Kong. Protesters in Hong Kong appeal to President Trump for help, and Beijing has a message for them. A new video shows Chinese troops rolling over mock protesters.
It is a warning. Don't go too far, because we can come in. And it's not a pretty sight. It is the use of force.
Also today, in the Bahamas, the rescue effort continues with some good news, a father and child reunion after the storm.
So she's good. Now I can focus on continuing to help. I'm fully focused.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World on a Monday. Chaos, pain, and finally for some, relief. A few of the feelings on board a ship carrying people from the Bahamas to safety in Florida. After Hurricane Dorian tore through the Bahamas, a mass exodus has not been easy. Emotionally, there have been lives destroyed by the storm, as well as final looks at homes and uncertainty about what lies ahead. Logistically, there's pressing technical concerns, for instance, getting permission and visas to come to the United States. Still, many from the Bahamas managed to board ships bound for Florida. Reporter Kayvon Antonio Hedari was on the first boat to leave Freeport, a ship bound for Florida. He told us what it was like for those families.
It was a pretty chaotic scene, people trying to get on the boat. They walked, they drove to the port of Freeport, and they were able to get over 1,000 people on this boat. There were people desperate to leave, people who had lost their houses, people who had family who had drowned. There's no food, there's no water, there's no electricity. So this was perhaps the only escape valve that they had.
Yeah, so 1,000 people, 1,000 stories of survival. What did you hear from them?
This one was basically a mini tsunami that came through with a storm surge, and the fact the storm was over them for 48 hours. Some of them, like John McKenzie, they would be in a house, and then when the storm would abate a little bit or the water would go down, they would move to another spot. And he lost two members of his family. In this transfer, they were moving from house to house when the storm came back over these 48 hours.
My cousin died. He died. Him and his wife died. His name was Will. He died. Him and his wife drowned. They'd only been married for 2 months, and they died, and they drowned. He actually drowned trying to save her because they came in a jet ski. He got saved on a jet ski. They came and got him, but he said he got to go back for his wife. So during the second trip, trying to go back for his wife, he died. He ended up losing his life, overwhelmed by the, you might say it's a tsunami, because that's how the flood was. It was like a tsunami that came to the Bahamas.
I also heard incredible stories, like a woman who tied herself to a tree trying to avoid the wind during a hurricane, but it was actually the flood that came above tree level that drowned her. Then there's others like Romeo Tibby, who was on the ship traveling with his daughter and no clothes, not even a bag.
Never know it's going to be like that bad. But it's calm, and we was underwater, but we just, God make it happen for us to be alive today.
Kayvon, once these 1,000-some-odd Bahamians landed there at the port of Palm Beach, what was their reaction? How did they look? How did they feel?
Well, they were very patient. They actually got a good meal on the ship and good breakfast, and then they waited to offboard. It took a few hours. And then the last group to unload, out of joy, they started singing in the passport line at the port.
Praise the Lord!
Well, safe and sound there. A lot of people, though, back in the Bahamas, still unaccounted for. But thanks for the good news from Miami. Reporter Kayvon Antonio Hedari, appreciate your time.
Thank you, Marco.
Later in the hour, we'll be back on the ground in the Bahamas checking on the rescue efforts there. The head of the Bahamas Air and Sea Rescue Association says he's overwhelmed by the unity of his neighbors. But for rescuers like him, now it's crunch time. That's still ahead this hour. They are dead. As far as I'm concerned, they are dead. That was President Trump's declaration this afternoon, saying that an attempt to reach an agreement with the Taliban is over. Negotiations to withdraw a substantial number of U.S. troops appear to be nearly complete, but it's been a whiplash 48 hours in the diplomatic world. On Saturday, the president said the secret meeting at Camp David is off. Stunning words, both secret meeting and off. Today, the president drove the diplomatic nail further into the coffin by saying negotiations are dead. The president has received criticism and praise for this. Sadiq Siddiqui, a spokesman for Afghan President Ashraf Ghani, said President Trump made the right call to call off talks.
How do you trust a group that at the same time they talk to you and then they kill people and then kill you? It's not possible.
And for many women, the collapse of the talks is a good thing, says Mary Akrami, who directs the Afghan Women Network. Akrami was a delegate to a landmark peace conference between the Taliban and Afghan officials last July in Doha. She says women now see renewed opportunity.
This news has so far made most people happy, particularly for the women. The way that the discussion was going, it was not accepted by most people during the last 8-9 months. We have called on both sides, particularly on Taliban, that they should, first of all, they should respect the ceasefire. Otherwise, it was disappointing most people. A lot of civilian casualty, and the people of Afghanistan were so worried. And now we're optimistic for the next round, and they should talk face to face.
As you know, though, the Taliban claims it respects women's rights, although that definitely was not the case 2 decades ago when they were in power. What do you think, Mary? Has the Taliban changed since it's been in power?
Unfortunately, it is just too early to say the Taliban, they have changed. They cannot convince us because part of the country which is under control of Taliban is still the girls are not allowed to go to school and they are not allowed to work. There is a lot of fundamentalism right now. Women and men are, according to the Constitution of Afghanistan, have equal rights. But for most part of the country is war and the conflict is going on. And we cannot say like all over the country, the people have equal rights.
That's what the Constitution says. The Taliban officials have called women intellectually and religiously incomplete. That's their word. So do you think the U.S. has been betraying Afghan women by negotiating with the Taliban in the first place?
The women of Afghanistan has changed a lot. During the last 18 years, the women have access to higher education. They were about to sign an agreement, but there is need for more open discussion between Afghans, between Taliban and government, and particularly the women should have a clear representative of the government or as a representative of the women of Afghanistan. They shouldn't see the woman as a victim anymore. They should see and respect women as a real change maker, as a responsible citizen of the country.
Since the Taliban have been pushed from power in 2002, what are the freedoms women have gained or are now clinging to that you most worry would disappear under an incomplete or a rush-through peace deal?
Now we have women in army, we have women in police, we have women as a doctors, we have millions of girls going to schools, thousands of doctors. They are all women. We have women as a minister, we have women as a ambassador, we have women in the parliament. We cannot compare.
And do you worry that all of those gains could just disappear if the Taliban are not at the table as solid, honest brokers?
Definitely. Women must be officially part of the negotiation, and they should be as a negotiator. They must listen to the women. We really want peace, but we want to be part of this, building this peace, because women of Afghanistan is not the woman of 20 or 19 years before.
Mary Akrami is the executive director of the Afghan Women Network. She's been speaking with us from Kabul. Mary, thanks so much for your time.
You are welcome.
So let's review. This weekend, President Trump revealed there was a secret Camp David summit. In the same tweet, he said it was canceled. Then today, he declared any talks between the U.S. and the Taliban to be dead. The Trump administration's handling of the process has left many observers bewildered. But how unusual is this style of diplomacy? Monica Duffy-Tomft is director of the Center for Strategic Studies at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. You've studied more than 100 conflicts, Monica. Is there any precedent for what the U.S. has been doing in talking with the Taliban?
Yes, there's precedent for it. You're just talking to the opposition. You're talking to the former, combatants that you were fighting. Of course, if you want to get a negotiated settlement, you have to, deal with them and have a dialogue. I think what was unprecedented was the lack of agreement within the administration, and in particular at the highest levels, and how it was going to be handled, and then how, when, you know, pulling the plug on it, how it was going to be announced. So the fact of the negotiations, that's good, actually, that, you know, we're thinking about bringing all of the parties perhaps to the table. At this point, it was just the Taliban, and trying to seek a negotiation, a political settlement to this war, because there's not going to be a military settlement. We've been trying that for 18 years. But I think what was odd about this was the manner in which the plug was pulled, and then the announcement, and actually many in the administration not being aware that the chief executive, who was going to, you know, bring the party there to finally sign and seal the deal, just made an announcement that, nope, it's not going to happen. We're done.
Well, when you have a civil war with a strong foreign intervention force like the U.S. in Afghanistan, typically, how do these conflicts end?
They usually end, well, they actually don't end. What you get is decades or, you know, years and years, if not decades, of continued very low activity. So I think what you'll likely see is each side arming themselves again and trying to defeat. I think the Taliban's made it very clear that it calls the Afghan government the stooge government, right? It sees it as a proxy for the United States. And so I do think you're going to see them trying to overthrow the government. And then I think you'll go into low scale, low intensity conflict for a very long time.
All right. That's a really depressing scenario. Let's just say, you know, what we've got facing us right now is a draft U.S. deal with the Taliban. It's been kind of walked away from. It did not even include a ceasefire. Where would you start again? I mean, we know the talks didn't include the Afghan government. What is needed for peace right now?
I think everybody needs to step back and take a deep breath. I think what really needs to be done is a little bit more patience in the sense of trying to get the two main parties in Afghanistan to talk to one another. I don't know how you do that. It's going to take a lot of time because both the Taliban now and the Afghan government feel as if the United States was not doing right by them. And so I think for a while the talks are going to be stalled. But then I think what they're going to have to do is diplomacy with both sides to try to bring them together. But the current administration, as you know, is very impatient. I mean, these things take years and years to negotiate.
And the Trump White House impatience, what's that about? Is that about 2020?
I think it is. I think that he, you know, President Trump said he was going to solve this problem, that he was going to bring peace to Afghanistan. And he does not appreciate, and I have to say, generally speaking, you know, how difficult diplomacy is, that it's not a business deal. You know, there's not necessarily a price to this, that people, you know, can be bought off with something, that you actually have to work really hard to understand the fundamental issues and work with the different parties and shuttle back and forth. And I actually was impressed. They, you know, there's 9 different meetings in Doha. Zalmay Khalilzad, you know, was the one negotiating this. And I guess what's really tragic about this is they were actually doing the right thing in taking a longer term sort of negotiating strategy, willing to work with the Taliban, finally recognizing that, yes, this is an indigenous and in the eyes of many Afghans, legitimate political group that should probably have a say at the table. And I guess what's so tragic is all of that work seems to have been tossed out because the president just decided that he was going to tweet and say, no, we're not going to go to Camp David. And on top of that, the way in which they were going to bring people to Camp David, not being fully honest and open about how that was going to be done. And so then the parties, even if they had gotten there, they may not have been willing to negotiate.
We'll leave it there, Monica. Monica Duffy-Toff, director of the Center for Strategic Studies at the Fletcher School at Tufts University in Medford, Massachusetts. Thanks very much, Monica.
Thank you, Margo. Have a great day.
Just ahead on the show, protesters in Hong Kong show no signs of letting up. And now they're appealing to President Trump to help them fight Beijing's power. But not everyone in Hong Kong agrees. Some see the protesters as traitors.
My country is going big and going strong and going powerful. They think, oh, you have no freedom at all in China. No, that's wrong. They have very good life over there.
Hong Kong is simmering. That's coming right up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. In Hong Kong, protesters show no signs of letting up. And this weekend, they appealed to someone new for help, President Donald Trump. Tens of thousands of people marched to the U.S. consulate there, some holding signs that said, President Trump, please save Hong Kong and make Hong Kong great again, a slogan Trump probably will appreciate. Many protesters were singing the Star Spangled Banner, waving U.S. flags, and shouting for the U.S. to liberate Hong Kong from China. This protester wants Washington to pass a bill that would make Hong Kong pass an annual human rights test in order for the island to hang on to its special trade status. But asking for the U.S. to get involved is a risky strategy, one that Beijing will not look on kindly. So just how much is Beijing willing to put up with? The World's Patrick Nguyen looks at that question from Hong Kong.
Show up in Hong Kong on a weekend, track down the roving protest, and you might find something like this. A sea of Hong Kongers in all black, masked up, some of them breaking stuff and barricading streets to fend off riot police. Stick around long enough and cops hunt them down, blast them with tear gas, bash them with batons. Here, police are wailing on people inside a subway car. Is this the new normal in Hong Kong? Well, you can still visit the city and avoid all this, but you will see graffiti sprayed around town. Stuff like Free Hong Kong, or slogans comparing China's Communist Party to Nazis. So, when will Beijing say enough? And what would that look like? Maybe like this. China's paramilitary police recently put out this video of a training exercise filmed right on the Hong Kong border. And they're just rolling over hordes of mock protesters. Innis Tang says real rioters should take note.
It's a warning. You should stop the riot. Otherwise, we have means to help you to stop it.
Tang is a native Hong Konger in his 50s. His day job is importing produce. But he's now finding his voice in politics. He's linked up with the pro-Beijing establishment, which pretty much runs Hong Kong. And he's been organizing pro-China rallies, where people wave the Chinese flag and sing patriotic anthems and generally put down the protesters as hooligans. Those who really don't like protesters have started calling them roaches. Tang tells me the other side, those pro-democracy rallies, he says you can barely even call them protests at this point.
A peaceful protest should not be throwing stone, a gasoline bomb. Everyone participating in this riot are traitors.
And not just traitors, but in his view, out-of-touch traitors. Have they not heard, he says, that China is going to be running the world soon? They don't want to get in on that?
My country is going big and going strong and going powerful. They think, oh, you have no freedom at all in China. No, that's wrong. They have very good life over there.
But not the freedom to mock the government or even go on Facebook. But Tang says social media is what whipped up the Arab Spring. And look what happened there. Now, he says, it's doing the same in Hong Kong.
We all enjoy the freedom of speech, but freedom has some limitations.
And there it is, the crux of Hong Kong's division. To the protesters, those limitations make them want to scream, no, back off. The real diehards almost view China as some occupying force. And if Beijing does send in the troops, you get the sense that they would almost relish the fight. Just listen to this statement from one of the frontline protesters.
Every time we go back to the front line, we make sure to have in our pockets our last will and testament. Because every time may be our last. Because we are ready and willing to lay down our lives.
Heavy stuff. So, what would make Beijing launch a crackdown? I asked Christine Low, a former policymaker under Hong Kong's last leader. She says China does have a red line.
The red line, the political red line, is don't call for independence. Don't call for anything that comes close to talking about independence.
Most protesters aren't calling for independence. But when Beijing says, Hong Kong, we're going to vet all of your politicians to make sure you don't elect anyone who even might be anti-China, that drives people into the streets. Or when Beijing secretly tells Hong Kong's government how to handle the protest, which the city's leader, Carrie Lam, admitted in a leaked recording, protesters will say, see, we're basically ruled by a puppet government. But Lo says, hold on, I was in government. It's not exactly like that.
So no one ever took you aside and said, Christine, we need to have a talk.
No, nobody ever did that to me.
You were able to pursue your portfolio without getting too many calls from...
I didn't get any call.
You didn't get any calls?
I didn't get any call. No one told me what to do.
Beijing actually doesn't want to micromanage every little thing in Hong Kong, she says. But chanting, free Hong Kong, burning Chinese flags, now you're coming close to that red line. Worse yet, Beijing keeps saying on state TV that this is all fueled by foreign agents.
Hong Kong is home to thousands of intelligence officers, earning the nickname the Asian Division of CIA. Agents from the UK and the US operate in Hong Kong without a single worry because the Chinese mainland has no jurisdiction over the city in accordance with...
A revolution incited by America? Big red line.
How sincerely do they believe that?
I think the officials in Beijing, I think they believe that. So they're not just saying it as an excuse.
Meanwhile, the videos keep coming. Here's the People's Liberation Army, this time the actual troops stationed in Hong Kong, crushing a mock protest like they're in some action movie.
It is a warning. Don't go too far, because we can come in. And it's not a pretty sight. It is the use of force.
Okay, let's end this on a less gloomy note. A little over a week ago, I'm standing next to this makeshift roadblock, which protesters are about to set on fire. I'm talking to a protester in her 30s, and I ask about those pro-China rallies, where people like her are called roaches or traitors.
Even though they are shouting at us, they are calling us a lot of dirty words. I don't care anymore. Words won't hurt us anymore.
But then I ask, okay, but would you ever sit down with them? Maybe have some tea? She actually said yes.
So you would talk to someone like that?
Why not? Come to us and talk to us under the condition that they truly want to talk.
I asked the pro-China rally organizer, Innes Tang, the same thing. His response, yes, because he says he gets that the protesters, in their own way, do love the city.
I think most of them have very good intentions. Talk is the only solution. We have to talk. We don't have to fight.
It's a glimmer of hope that maybe the two sides might be able to see their rivals not as Nazis or roaches, but as fellow Hong Kongers. For The World, Patrick Nguyen, Hong Kong.
You're listening to The World. An Arizona rancher supports Trump, but not the border wall near his land.
Well, it's so easy to breach it. You can climb over it, you can cut it, you can do whatever you want with it. The bottom line is you have to have agents on the ground, and that's never happened.
And a new stretch of wall planned nearby, it could block the last free-flowing river in Arizona. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, PRI, and PRX. It's been just over a week since Hurricane Dorian first tore through the Bahamas. Dozens of people are confirmed dead, hundreds missing, and around 70,000 people are homeless. During the storm and its aftermath, we've been in touch with Eddie Wan. Wan is the chairman of the Bahamas Air and Sea Rescue Association in Freeport. He's been heading up rescue efforts there. For days, Wan could not even reach his own family members, including his 12-year-old daughter, on the Abaco Islands in the Bahamas. Eddie Wan gave us an update today on how things are going.
Okay, I finally spoke with my daughter on Wednesday. Actually, the island that she was on in the Abacos got completely demolished. And she was physically, she's okay, emotionally, mentally. She's distraught. The house that she was in with her mother got hit by a tornado and literally just leveled. They were actually in the bathroom for some 7 hours with a couple of walls around them, and the roof obviously torn off. The rest of the house all around them is gone. When they came out, there was literally nothing there. I actually worked very closely with the Coast Guard, and they were kind enough to drop a chopper in there yesterday morning and picked her and her grandmother up and took them to safety. Actually, I wanted them here in Freeport with me, obviously, but her grandmother's a little ill, and the hospital here was compromised with the flooding, so they took them to Nassau. But luckily, I have a family there. My brother picked her up and secured her, and now she's fine. And she'll be going this afternoon, actually, to my son in Florida. So she's good. Now I can focus on continuing to help. I'm fully focused.
I suspect it is going to be tough days ahead for your daughter. But as you say, you can now focus on what is at hand. What is at hand? What are you facing? What is the scene in some of the worst parts of the islands that have been destroyed?
Grand Bahama's worst is the flooding, terrible flooding here, some cases up to 12 feet. We have had a lot of loss of life due to drownings, literally in their attics, families in their attics, and the water just kept rising and rising and rising, and really nowhere else to go. Some cases, they were not prepared. They didn't take a hatchet or anything, a hammer or something, to bang themselves out through the roof if they had to, if the water raised that high. And unfortunately, we lost some. A lot of people not being able to get out. Some people were able to get out and were able to swim to, not to safety per se, but at least to avoid from drowning. During the storm, when wind subsided enough for us to go out, sometimes 120, 130 mile an hour, we were out there. We had wave runners. We had bulldozers. We had boats. We had, you name it, we had it. Going in, we had dump trucks. I hooked up my tractor head to a 40-foot container and just drove down roads and people just climbing in the containers. Whatever [S2] Wow. [S1] We needed to do, we did. And day before yesterday, we were still pulling people because a certain section of the island was, the roads were unpassable, so we had to do it via helicopter and boats to rescue people from the eastern end of the island.
Have you been in the unfortunate position of retrieving the dead?
Yes, we have, and it's that's the one thing that when I break down, I'm somewhat of an emotional person, and when that happens, and you're bringing in parish people, it hurts. It hurts, especially children, and it seriously hurts. It tears me apart.
Eddie, what is the mood right now in some of the shelters? I'm thinking of public schools where, you know, hundreds of people are kind of going, people who have lost everything.
I'm sure it gets a little antsy at times. I'm sure tempers might flare here and there and people are getting agitated. But at the same time, as I explained in our last conversation, that we are a Christian nation and we all do pull together. I'm so amazed at the way Grand Bahama is pulling together. I haven't seen a whole heck of a lot of tempers flaring. But, you know, when you're working on 27 hours sleep for 7 nights, you know, anything can happen. And that's where I am personally. Right now, everybody has to pool together. No matter if I like you, if you don't like me, I don't care or less either way. It's kind of crunch time, if you will. We're in a disaster area. We need to help each other.
Eddie Juan, the chairman of BASRA, that's the Bahamas Air and Sea Rescue Association. He's been speaking with us from Freeport. Eddie, thanks for speaking with us again. It's great news about your daughter. Thanks, and good luck moving ahead.
God bless, guys.
The Trump administration is moving ahead on plans to expand the wall on the U.S.-Mexico border. It's even diverting several billion dollars in military funds to jumpstart some construction. In Arizona, the plan is to build or replace more than 60 miles of border wall, mainly across federally protected lands. Conservation groups are suing. One key concern is the fate of the last undammed river in Arizona. From Arizona Public Media in Tucson, Ariana Brocious has our story.
John Ladd's family has run cattle on the same land for more than a century. Purple Mountains rise in the distance above his Ocotillo and agave-studded ranch. We're in his red truck, driving south toward the U.S.-Mexico border.
Is this up here, that white tower? Is that Border Patrol?
Yeah, that's a permanent camera.
Ladd says that camera is one of four on his ranch. There's also a radar station. He's given Border Patrol access to his property for nearly 30 years. He says he felt overwhelmed by the drug and human traffic crossing his land.
They caught a 500,000 illegals on us. Just on our ranch. Nobody believes that, but a lot of people came through here.
That figure for his ranch is probably high, But in the 1990s, hundreds of thousands of people crossed the Arizona border every year. The number has gone down since then. After about 15 minutes, we reached the border fence, which runs along 10.5 miles of Ladd's property and beyond. It was built in stages about a decade ago. Here, the wall is 10-foot-tall metal mesh.
Well, it's so easy to breach it. You can climb over it, you can cut it, you can do whatever you want with it.
We drive farther down the wall to a spot with 14-foot bollards. These are square steel posts spaced 4 inches apart. Customs and Border Protection plans to build an even taller version of this kind of fencing across 60-some miles of desert along the Arizona border, mostly through national monuments and wildlife refuges set aside for federal protection.
We are absolutely fundamentally opposed to this project.
Lakin Jordahl is with the Center for Biological Diversity, a Tucson-based group leading the opposition to the project. His group says the bollard fencing would cause irreparable harm to the many species that depend on cross-border migration corridors, even birds and butterflies.
A 30-foot-high solid steel bollard wall would stop almost every wildlife species in their tracks.
The Fish and Wildlife Service has also raised concerns, and there's one stretch in particular that people are worried about, the San Pedro River, which runs from Mexico into the U.S. near John Ladd's property.
Okay, so we're walking down to the San Pedro, and what do we see?
Well, there isn't any water.
It's been a dry summer, but this riverbed often floods during the summer monsoons. So Border Patrol removes the vehicle barriers, metal X's made from old railroad ties, that are in place the rest of the year. For 3 months, there's no fence, just a Border Patrol agent in a truck, watching the open riverbed. The plan is to build some kind of a bollard barrier across the riverbed. The Bureau of Land Management has said it would be a, quote, engineering challenge. Conservationist Jordahl says it goes beyond that.
Anything that would stop the passage of people through this area would also stop the flow of water. So we're really concerned that what they're proposing for the San Pedro might actually create a dam. And I think something really special would be lost if we end up damming the last free-flowing river in Arizona.
And conservationists on the Mexican side of the border have raised similar concerns. Ladd and I return from the riverbed to visit another section of bollard fencing in a low-water crossing. This one has 4-foot-high gates that can be opened to allow for the flow of water. But even with the gates, piles of debris have accumulated behind the steel posts.
It's designed that this debris comes in on the floods, and that's why they think, well, we can open the gate out and it'll clean itself out. Well, it doesn't.
Ladd supports President Trump and the border wall in general, but he thinks building a barrier across the San Pedro is a waste of time and money.
Why put yourself in that position of the liability of a structure washing out and then having to do environmental cleanup afterwards?
The Cochise County Sheriff says they've seen more success deterring illegal immigration and drug smuggling by deploying hundreds of wildlife cameras and convicting those they catch. Ladd agrees a border wall isn't the only solution, and he thinks more cameras can help.
But the bottom line is you have to have agents on the ground, and that's never happened.
We saw 3 or 4 Border Patrol vehicles in a couple of hours traveling along this section of border wall, but Ladd says that's not nearly enough. CBP didn't respond to an interview request for this story, but in its response to the legal challenge, it said it hasn't finalized plans for the San Pedro wall and is planning to do geotechnical surveys of the riverbed in September. Construction could begin as early as October. For The World, Ariana Brocious, Tucson.
For several years, Russia and Ukraine have been in a bitter conflict. It began 5 years ago when Moscow annexed Crimea, a peninsula off the southern coast of Ukraine. This weekend, Ukraine and Russia made moves that some see as a sign of improving relations. They completed a long-awaited prisoner swap. Reporter Charles Maines has been following this from Moscow. What's the context and backstory here, Charles? What led up to this prisoner swap?
Well, key to this was the election of Volodymyr Zelensky, the new Ukrainian president. He was elected in April, promising to bring Ukrainian prisoners from Russia home. The problem was that Russian President Vladimir Putin refused to talk to him initially. The two leaders only finally spoke for the first time in July, when the prisoner swap issue was first discussed between them. And in recent days, both leaders hinted that a deal was imminent. So the action unfolded here on Saturday morning. You had 35 people from each side freed.
So who was actually released in this prisoner swap?
Well, Ukrainian President Zelensky joined families down at the tarmac for what was, as you can imagine, a pretty emotional day for them. From the Ukrainian side, we saw the release of 24 sailors who were captured by Russia off the coast of Crimea last November. But the biggest cheers came for Ukrainian filmmaker Oleg Sentsov. Now, Sentsov served 5 years of a 20-year sentence stemming from his opposition to Russia's annexation of the Crimean Peninsula. Sentsov is from Crimea. He also captured international attention because he led a 145-day hunger strike in an effort to free other Ukrainians imprisoned in Russia. So with his release, he made clear he still hasn't forgotten these other Ukrainians still back in jail in Russia. And so this is Sentsov speaking in Russian. He says he hopes other hostages will be freed soon. But even with the last prisoner freed, our fight is not over. I assume that's a reference to the fact that Crimea, of course, is still under Russian control.
So what about the prisoners Ukraine released back to Russia? Who are they?
Well, it was a starkly different scene here in Moscow from what we saw in Kiev. First of all, Vladimir Putin, of course, wasn't out on the tarmac. It was basically just a few Russian state media TV cameras that were there to focus on one person, a Russian journalist who was released by Kiev. But meanwhile, most of the other Russians, they were our Russian army conscripts who once fought on the side of pro-Russian separatists in East Ukraine, where this war has been going on now for 5 years. And it was, in fact, their capture that seemed to prove what Moscow has always denied about the war in East Ukraine, that, in fact, Russia is part of the conflict. So there wasn't a hero's welcome for them. And, in fact, it turns out that the families weren't warned at all.
Hello.
I reached out to Svetlana Ageeva, whose son Viktor was a Russian army soldier, a grunt, essentially, captured by Ukraine while fighting in East Ukraine. Svetlana says she only learned of Viktor's release when she saw her son in Moscow live on state TV. You know, of course, she'd heard these rumors of the exchange and hoped that Viktor was on the list, but nobody warned her about it. And, of course, she's thrilled to get him back home. In fact, they're planning to throw a big party for Viktor when she does.
Now, Charles, Dutch officials are condemning the release of one particular prisoner. Who is he and why this reaction from the Netherlands?
Yeah, this has to do with a guy named Volodymyr Simakh, a former commander of Russian-backed separatists in East Ukraine who was captured by Ukrainian forces in June this summer. Now, Ukraine security forces have identified Simakh as a key witness in the downing of Malaysian Airlines flight MH17, which some people may remember was shot down over East Ukraine in July of 2014. This killed all 298 people aboard, most of them citizens of the Netherlands, which explains the Dutch interest. Now, Dutch prosecutors investigating the tragedy have said that, you know, Russia provided the missile that shot down this plane. And of course, they look at this Simakh as a person of interest in their work. Now, it's worth pointing out that Simakh is actually a Ukrainian citizen, and we understand that the entire prisoner exchange really hinged on Moscow's demands that Simakh be included. Huh. So Ukraine had to make a really tough choice here, and obviously Zelensky, the Ukrainian leader, decided to go through with it in the end.
Just how significant is this swap? I mean, some people say it's a sign of improving relations between Russia and Ukraine, but is it?
Well, I think it's a long way still to go on that front. Remember, Russia seized Crimea from Ukraine in 2014, triggering, of course, Western sanctions from the U.S. and the EU. But, you know, Russia says this is a done deal. It's non-negotiable. Crimea is now part of the Russian Federation. In fact, they've built a bridge to connect Crimea to the Russian mainland. Meanwhile, Kiev says its goal is to restore its rightful territory. Then again, you know, Zelensky comes to power promising not only prisoner exchanges, but also to end the war in East Ukraine, which has killed over 13,000 people over the last 5 years. And that's really where all the fighting's been. So it's hard not at least to see this as a step forward. I mean, you have to start somewhere.
Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow, thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Something remarkable happened in Moscow. In municipal elections on Sunday, President Vladimir Putin's party, United Russia, got trounced big time. That's opposition leader Alexei Navalny explaining how it happened. On his suggestion, anti-Putin voters decided to vote for anyone other than a candidate from Putin's party, even candidates that voters might otherwise find distasteful, communists, independents, whomever. There's a reason Moscow voters did this. The Kremlin kept more than 200 of the favored candidates off the ballot. Konstantin Sonin held his nose at the polls. He's an economics professor at the University of Chicago and flew home to Moscow to cast his ballot.
For the first time in my life, and I'm 47, I voted for a communist. This communist, his name is Nikolai Gubenko. When I was a kid, he was famous in Russian movies because he played young Lenin.
Like on TV shows and in the movies?
Mostly in the movies.
Right. So he is still a dyed-in-the-wool communist.
I think he spent the last 30 years basically being a candidate in all kind of local and national elections on the Communist Party platform.
And Konstantin, why did you feel it was important to vote for him, regardless of how this election turned out?
I wanted to tell the Moscow government and perhaps the Putin government that this is not the way to organize elections when a lot of good candidates who collected enough signatures, they were barred from participating in these elections. So to vote for someone who is that repulsive but still is not the best choice of the Moscow government was my way to vote against all candidates.
What was your just emotional kind of raw reaction to voting for a candidate you just disagree with?
I thought that it's a sort of a weird thing to do. But I also remembered that 30 years ago, when I was voting for the first time in the Soviet Union, I also participated in quite a weird voting. And when I was a kid, I would go to the election booths with my parents. In the Soviet Union, it was almost obligatory to vote, but there was always a single candidate, and the results would be that there was a 99% vote for this single candidate. So I have my experience of weird voting, so I have a kind of a flashback of these memories.
And how does it feel now to see the kind of smart voting strategy results where Putin and United Russia got crowded out in Moscow city elections, but it does kind of lead to a somewhat confusing Moscow city council?
I very much hope that Putin and his administration, they will take this as a very strong signal that a lot of Russians, millions of Russians, millions of Moscovites need political representation, that there are a lot of young people who would want their voice to be heard. So I think they need to suppress less the candidates of the opposition and allow opposition leaders to stand for parliament in the parliamentary elections.
Konstantin Sonin, an economics professor at the University of Chicago. He also writes a blog on Russian political and economic issues. Konstantin, thank you.
Thank you.
As for reaction from the Kremlin to the Moscow municipal election results, they're brushing all of this off. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said, nationally, Putin's United Russia Party won a vast majority of the elections. And while the party lost about a third of its seats in Moscow, it remains on course to hold onto its majority there. If you think your neighbors are bad, check this out. In 1704, Lilias Adie was just minding her own business in Scotland when her neighbor accused her of witchcraft and having an affair with the devil. Adie was sentenced to be burned at the stake, but she died in prison. Over the years, her grave was robbed by some, her body exhumed by others, and pieces of her bones and coffin ended up all over the place. Now the Scottish town of Fife wants her remains back to create a memorial to honor Adie and other victims of witch hunts. Kate Stewart is a councillor for West Fife and coastal villages in Scotland. She believes they'll be able to find Adie's remains.
The last known sighting of the skull and the bones were in 1938 at a great exhibition in Bellahouston in Glasgow. It's a distinctive skull. Because, you know, the photos that were taken by St Andrews University students at the time that it was they were sold, they have recorded that she had prominent teeth and that they were very prominent. So that makes it distinctive that we would recognise Lilias if we were able for somebody to find her.
Yeah, and it will be challenging because these remains and what was in the grave are kind of all over the world. Am I correct? The millionaire industrialist Andrew Carnegie owned a walking stick made from the wood of her coffin?
Yes, that's correct.
Wow.
There was what they call curio hunters that dug up her remains and sold them to the students. But there was also the wood taken from her coffin, or it was a big box at the time. It wasn't even a proper coffin. And they made two walking sticks. And these guys had connections with Andrew Carnegie. And they presented two walking sticks to Andrew Carnegie. And after Carnegie's death, exhibits were sent over and put in the Birthplace Museum in Dunfermline. So that walking stick is still there.
What prompted this whole reappreciation of Lilis? I mean, at the time in the 1700s, she was feared, she was scorned, and ultimately brutalized to, you know, her grave.
Yes, and it was mainly gender bias because in Scotland it was over 80% were women.
I'm curious to know how that has impacted, you think, the way this history has been remembered until now, the fact that, you know, 80% of these victims of witch hunts were women.
Well, we have the Disney type people associate with witches. Women are ugly, pointed noses, black caps, broomsticks and all that. So it's all the negative aspect. So it's about turning that story round about and actually letting people know the real story, that these women were targeted. They were ordinary people, really.
What lessons from AD's story and the others that she represents do you think are relevant today?
That there is no justification in persecuting people because of their looks, the way they act or whatever. And we see some nowadays that women are speaking out because of what they've endured through people maybe in positions of power, because that's what happened there as well. And again, that is an injustice, and it's injustices that we should be calling out.
Well, Kate, I hope some of our listeners can help you in finding some of the remains of Lilis Eide and give her a respectful memorial. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
That was Kate Stewart, a counselor for West Fife in Scotland, trying to right the wrongs of witch hunts centuries ago. And that's what we've got for you today. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. See you back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.